And that there's no chalk. Damn it. Chalk shortage has finally manifested itself. I just came back from Europe, so I haven't had a chance to mark the tests yet, but by Thursday I will have marked them, so I'll give them back to you. I was at a conference in Poland. It was heartwarming because the Polish scholars there were all very much against the government. They were all completely courageous, lashed out at the government at all times, and no respect for any of its pronouncements. And very feisty. I think that's really heartwarming. None of them believe anything the government says. It's a good, healthy attitude. Okay, as I said, Teddy Roosevelt had been the Morgan candidate for vice president. He replaced Garrett Hobart, who died in office. McKinley hated him, and Mark Hanna hated Roosevelt and tried to get other Morgan people to accept the vice presidential nomination. They refused to do it. They were stuck with Teddy, but they figured, well, after all, Teddy was the vice presidential candidate and a few years ago. And his plan was that after McKinley's two terms, Mark Hanna would run for president. Rockefeller was backing him to the hilt. And something happened on the way to the White House, of course, namely that McKinley was assassinated by one of the many lone nuts that have appeared in American history. The assassination date, September 1901, early in those days, the president took office in March instead of in January, so essentially McKinley was only in for about 8 months or so in 1901. Assassinations. If you notice in the history of the United, there have been many assassinations in America of American presidents and American politics. There have been many assassinations in the world. In all the rest of the world, Europe, Asia, Africa, whenever somebody's assassinated, it's always assumed there was some political motivation for this thing. Some political group was doing it. And the police tactics, when any individual is murdered, you look for means, motive, and opportunity, the famous triad. And motive becomes the key thing. It doesn't mean the person who had the motive was the guilty person, but the person you look at first. In other words, some millionaire dies, is murdered. You look to the grieving widow. Was the grieving widow responsible? Doesn't mean she was responsible. Since she inherited $5 million, she becomes the first suspect. This is never done in the United States. For some reason, an American president or big shot is assassinated. Nobody ever talks about political motivation. It's always some lone nut. The guy's a nut. You find the guy very quickly, and you cart him away as being a nut. And it seems to me rather peculiar that the usual police work never applied to American presidents. Now, you don't look at who was the beneficiary. Who benefited when, for example, when McKinley was assassinated? Well, obviously, Teddy Roosevelt benefited, the vice president. Somehow he was never suspected. He was never put on the police grilling, or suspected, or the Morgan people, of course, then take over, because Morgan all of a sudden becomes, the Morgans now have a president, which they were not likely to have in any other situation. It doesn't mean the Morgans did it, it doesn't mean that Teddy Roosevelt did it, but at least he should have been, at least historians, people at the time, and historians should at least have a certain suspicion, at least investigate the possibility that this was a Morgan set-up job. Instead, it was a lone nut, some guy named Charles Gudge. They dispose of Charles Gudge quickly, they try him as a lone nut, they execute him, and that's the end of it. When Huey Long was assassinated in 1936 or 35, it was going to be a very powerful challenge to Franklin Roosevelt's second term, Democratic ticket. He was assassinated, and his guards immediately, of course, killed the guy, and that was the end of it. It was never considered to be any kind of political plan or conspiracy at work. So it's kind of odd that in the United States you have this innocent, sort of official innocence applied to assassination. It has to be a lone nut. You never even think of the possibility of maybe other people involved, maybe political motivations or whatever. In the case of President Kennedy, of course, our most recent assassinee, obviously the major recipient was Lyndon Johnson. Doesn't mean Lyndon Johnson was behind it, just means it at least should have been entertained as a possibility by the media and by the police and by the Department of Justice or whatever. Because it becomes difficult if the vice president isn't really responsible and assumes office. It's difficult for the Department of Justice to undertake a serious investigation of the person who's now president, and therefore the boss of the Department of Justice. As we saw with Watergate, it becomes very difficult. You had to have special counselors, you know, all the rest of the. But the lone nut scheme has always been operative in the United States. At any rate, as a matter of fact, there had been several assassinations before. President Garfield was assassinated by a lone nut in 1881. Succeeded by Chester Arthur, Garfield was hated by the Tammany types, the official bosses. Before that, had been some. Of course, Lincoln was assassinated. Again, with Lincoln, even though obviously they had to admit there was a conspiracy involved, even though the focus of historians is always on John Wilkes Booth, but obviously there were many people involved. But they were locked up. What happened there was a military trial. And all these guys were killed very quickly, without in secret. In other words, there was no real public trial. Investigate why they did it, who did it, and that sort of stuff. There have also been some mysterious deaths in the presidency. Zachary Taylor became president in 1840, 1848. Was elected as a Whig, and even though he was a slaveholder himself, he came from Virginia, he suddenly became anti-slavery, and since he led the fight against expansion of slavery into the West. He died in mysterious circumstances after a July 4th picnic, died of gastrointestinal poisoning. The thing is, he was the only one who was poisoned. You have 200 people at a picnic, you have poison, whatever it is, anchovies or mayonnaise sandwiches, several people get food poisoning. Why did only one guy, the president, get food poisoning and nobody else? This has never been seriously investigated. The death of Harding was kind of peculiar, too. There was a contention by one of the Secret Service people who wrote a book after Harding died in office that his wife was responsible, poisoned them because of the Harding scandals. But I'm not taking this as official. That's probably eccentric. But the point is that there have been none of these contentions have been seriously investigated. At any rate, we have a lone nut, and he kills McKinley, and all of a sudden the Morgans get a president. And Teddy Roosevelt starts using this to the hilt. It's not as if he was passive. He took full use of this golden opportunity to get a true Morgan presidency in office. What does he do? Okay, as soon as he begins to be president, he assumes the presidency in November. He writes his first speech, I think, in December. His first message to Congress. Yeah. Oh yeah, absolutely. With the mafia, with the CIA, and all. Yeah, there's a lot of stuff has been written on that. It's pretty conclusive, I think, that the mafia is largely responsible. But the thing is that the media hasn't really accepted this. I mean, there's been a lot of books on it, but the official media, the CBS, NBC, the New York Times, etc., never accepted this. I mean, the congressional investigation said there were at least three shots. And it gets buried on page 85 or something. The paper is never really taken seriously. You know, I think most of the public agrees with this revisionist view. Oh, yeah. There's a lot of stuff that has been written on it, some good books on it. Anthony Summers, probably the best two Anthony Summers conspiracy, which sums up the latest mafia stuff. And a book by David Lifton called Best Evidence, which deals with the whole bullet problem. He focused on the bullet. There's also a charming thing, which I have no proof for. It's never been published. I happen to see the manuscript. It's obvious why it wasn't published. This is a book by Fred Richmond, some other guy. Fred Richmond is some sort of libertarian. And the book focused on the only book that I know of, I'm a sort of Kennedy assassination buff. The only book I know of was focused on the entourage, on the car, the presidential, vice presidential car. His view was the Secret Service killed Kennedy in the car. It's probably on sound. But the interesting thing about this, he focused on the cars, the entourage, and how the route changed in the last minute, like the night before, they suddenly changed the route, go through Dealey Plaza instead of through the right on the freeway. Okay? They could easily be shot at. Anyway, he claims that the Kennedy's head, as they turn the corner, apparently the back seat could be raised so he can make whoever the big shot in the back seat more visible. He claims that he measures the distance of the back seat. He's the only one who ever did this. And it shows that the Kennedy seat goes up by several inches to make him a better target. As he rounds the corner, and the Secret Service guy in the front was the guy who manipulated the lever. He's the only one who had the lever. See, as soon as Kennedy was assassinated, they destroyed the car. They took the car somewhere and they destroyed it. There was no way to get any evidence out of the car. At any rate, then another thing is that usually in presidential entourage, the vice president is in the car behind, right? He's the president. He's the vice president. So somehow this gets changed at the last minute, so Johnson's car is like six or seven cars behind. And as they round the corner, he's looking at the entourage, and he claims that we know that Johnson's dives to the floorboards as soon as the shots ring out, of course. But he claims that Johnson dives to the front of the car 2.5 seconds before the first shot. It's one of the great moments. This never got published. Anyway, that's a charming doctrine. He also claimed, he said, well, up until now, nobody has said who the killer was. I named the killer, the Secret Service agent sitting in the front, Robert Bowker, whatever his name was. So he wondered why he never got that published. At any rate, first thing that Teddy Roosevelt does, he revives an old proposal for a new cabinet department of commerce and labor. Before that, there was no commerce department, there was no labor department. Serve as a means of subsidizing and regulating commerce and industry. He immediately starts in very quickly. He also urged a federal board, like the ICC, to supervise industrial combinations. In other words, like the ICC for the railroads, this is a Morgan position now, the official Morgan position, which most big businessmen now adopt in the next few years. That we need, and I keep repeating this on and on, we need to do for industry in general what the ICC did for the railroad. Notice four, not two. They did for the railroads. They helped the railroads by cartelizing them, by regulating them, by raising rates, by keeping out competition. Just as we needed an ICC for the railroads, we also need now a Federal Trade Commission, or a Federal Commerce Commission, whatever, for general industry. In other words, to cartelize industry in general, like the ICC did for the railroads. So Roosevelt starts talking about that immediately. Before he writes his speech, he clears it with two friends, two good friends and advisors. George W. Perkins, Morgan Partner, and Robert Bacon, Morgan Partner. Now these are his two guys, and yes, great stuff, Teddy, fire away. So from the very beginning, he starts with Morgan Partner. As a matter of fact, as soon as the election of 1900 was over, I should say this before the assassination, as soon as the election is over in late November, Teddy Roosevelt, now vice president, gives a lavish dinner in honor of who? J.P. Morgan. Because without J.P. Morgan, he would never have achieved his stature, which of course is true. No gift was ever more deserved. his first message to Congress, after McKinley is assassinated, he calls for checking with Perkins and Bacon, two top Morgan partners. He calls for federal regulation of corporations, a Federal Commerce Commission of some sort to regulate an industry, to investigate corporations. And the first thing he pushes is what he pushed, as I remember I said on the tape, Jeremiah W. Jenks, Cornell University economist, one of the so-called new breed economists, compulsory publicity. Corporations should have to open their books to federal regulations so that we know, everybody knows what their prices they're charging, what they're doing, etc. And notice what this means. Again, we know from cartels. Cartels break up. One of the things that breaks up cartels is because secret price cutting. So what the cartelists, those who want a compulsory cartel, which is the Morgan interests, they want to first and foremost, the first step, compulsory publicity. Don't let them have secret price cutting. This is one way to do it. So it sounds very democratic, it sounds great, publicity is good, secrecy is bad, but what it really means is to break up cartels, from being broken up by not allowing secret price cutting. So Jenks was the first economist theoretician of compulsory publicity, and this of course was the Morgan line. And throughout the summer of 1902, Roosevelt, his first summer in office, he peppers his speeches constantly with calls for compulsory publicity in order to curb what he called business evils. He found a strong ally in the Attorney General, who he inherited from McKinley, but he had just become Attorney General like a few months before, a very important figure named Philander Knox. Philander Knox was a Pittsburgh corporate lawyer, and therefore, of course, a tool of the Mellon interests. Mellon National Bank was a major financier of Pittsburgh, very closely tied in with Frick and Carnegie. Carnegie Frick Steel interests. What happened in 1901, just about this time, you see, is that the Carnegie Frick merged into the U.S. Steel. In other words, merged into the great Morgan Empire. Carnegie decided he wanted to retire and sold out to this new U.S. Steel Corporation. So in other words, Mellon was tied in with Morgan. And so Philander Knox becomes a Morgan tool by virtue of his connection with Mellon Carnegie and Mellon Carnegie Frick interests. So he was very happy to start this fantastic campaign of Teddy Roosevelt, which I'll mention and get to in a second. Frick, by the way, was now a major shareholder, of course, Frick and Carnegie, major shareholders in U.S. Steel. So they were tied in through, in other words, here you own a business, you're a big shot in a business, you sell out of this big holding company, you become a major shareholder in the new holding company. So you're tied in with the Morgan interests more or less permanently. and Frick is now Knox is now urging Teddy Roosevelt to establish a commission with compulsory power to obtain information, to subpoena information from corporations, and to report to the president. And Roosevelt then submits this proposal to Congress early in 1903. A new Department of Commerce and Labor, which he already proposed, plus this new compulsory publicity power, and something called a Bureau of Corporations, which would be attached to this new department. So, this, as I say, was the Morgan line. there had been a previous U.S. Industrial Commission, which late McKinley had launched late in his administration, where Jenks was again running the thing, also calling for compulsory publicity. It all fits into this new trend, you say. And then Roosevelt, as I say, submits this bill to Congress. He should have a Bureau of Corporations with the power to investigate all subpoena corporations' books and so forth and so on. The first big regulatory agency for business in general. The major guy pushing it, of course, is George W. Perkins, Morgan partner. Morgan's main guy in politics is lobbying the thing through Congress. And Perkins, by the way, was the main guy who helped Morgan form U.S. Steel and International Harvester, the two big Morgan industrial trusts, in 1901. Perkins and Roosevelt's formulating his famous doctrine, which Perkins also, of course, formulated for him. There are two kinds of trusts, they said. It's very famous. Even the Orthodox historians proclaim this. The good trusts and the bad trusts. Good trusts are great and they should be sponsored and helped. Bad trusts are bad and should be broken up. What is the criterion for good trusts and bad trusts? Well, there's no criterion. It's all subjective. Whether Teddy Roosevelt likes them or not. And in practice, what it meant, the good trust was a Morgan trust. Morgan good. It means General Electric. It means U.S. Steel, International Harvester, etc. The bad trusts were anything connected with Rockefeller and Harriman. And now we get back to the by definition. This is a moral criterion, goodness and badness. Morgan good, Rockefeller bad. Now Harriman, I don't know if I mentioned this or not yet, but if I did, I repeat it. Harriman was a brilliant Wall Street broker who started, I guess he marries this girl and inherits a small railroad in upstate New York and builds up from that, from financial genius, and no question about that, and becomes a big railroad owner and really starts running Central Pacific, gets control of Central Pacific and Southern Pacific, and moves in on Union Pacific, and excuse me, on Northern Pacific, and moves in on Northern Pacific, and Morgan had been controlling it. There's a tremendous fight around 1902, around this whole period, you see. Tremendous fight, stock fight between the Morgan and Hill on the one hand, Hill of Great Northern. They formed an alliance to keep control of Northern Pacific, versus Harriman, who was trying to get a hold of it, becomes a big railroad tycoon. Harriman joined up with Rockefeller, pouring in a lot of money. And Kuhn Loeb is the investment banker. So this is, Kuhn Loeb is coming up fast. There's a big cultural problem between Morgan and Kuhn Loeb. Kuhn Loeb were German-Jewish investment bankers in New York. And getting headed by Jacob Schiff. And these form a titanic struggle, titanic fight, stock fight between the Morgan Hill forces versus the Harriman Rockefeller Kuhn Loeb force. The interesting thing is Harriman Rockefeller Kuhn Loeb have been aligned almost ever since. In other words, this alliance continued from about 1901 until the 1940s, let's say. The And Morgan and Hill finally won out. They formed the after a big struggle. By the way, Morgan, of course, hated Rockefeller and also hated Harriman. A bitter, bitter hatred of Harriman. Harriman was challenging Morgan on the railroads. Morgan had run owned practically every railroad. All of a sudden, this young pup, this young whippersnapper, is challenging the great Morgan. He referred to him as a little punk, for example, one of the many references to Harriman by Morgan. Also, there's a cultural problem here, Harriman being short and thin and Morgan being big, tall, strapping figures. There's sort of a cultural clash between short people and tall people. Some people might consider this insignificant, but it all works in. It all works out of the great for the picture. Any rate, there's a personal hatred between the two, in addition to their economic struggle, financial struggle. At any rate, what finally happens by 1902 is that Morgan wins that, but they come to an agreement where they form a Northern Securities Corporation, which is a holding company for both Great Northern, which was Hill's railroad, remember the one going up around the Canadian border to Seattle, and Northern Pacific, which went to Portland, and combining both of them. In other words, the shareholders combine their shares and they all become shareholders of one Great Northern Securities Corporation. They worked it out to about 2-1 for Morgan. In other words, I think there were 15 members of the board of directors, and 10 of them were Morgan people, and 5 of them were Harriman Rockefeller people. So, anyway, around 1902, get this. oh, by the way, so I just mentioned that. In 1903, when Teddy Roosevelt was driving through the Bureau of Corporations bill through Congress, Rockefeller was all in favor of this new trend toward business government cooperation. However, problem was that Morgan and Rockefeller now at big odds, hated each other, so Rockefeller lobbied against it. In other words, Rockefeller and his Standard Oil argued, about the only big business group that argued against the Bureau of Corporations bill, set up this bureau to eventually regulate industry. And Teddy Roosevelt then really lashes out and says that apparently what happened was that John D. Rockefeller Jr. sent a telegram to various congressmen urging them not to pass the bill. Teddy Roosevelt holds a press conference and says, John D. Rockefeller Sr. did it. Of course, John D. Rockefeller Sr. is generally hated by almost everybody. Nobody ever heard of John D. Rockefeller Jr., so Teddy Roosevelt just sort of escalated it, lied about who actually sent the telegram, and the bill passed. Before he appointed the commissioner of corporations named James Garfield, he checked with Francis Lynn Stetson, who was a attorney for the House of Morgan, to make sure this guy was okay. In other words, again, another one of his top advisors. Remember, Stetson was the same guy who was Grover Cleveland's top advisor and also law partner. So we have the Morgan connection moving in here, even though Roosevelt was a Republican and Cleveland was a Democrat, and they were very different ideologically. It all boils down to Morgan domination. well, around 1903, after he passes this, a strange thing happens, namely that Teddy Roosevelt, after having a cozy arrangement with the U.S. Steel Trust and General International Harvester and all that, takes the Sherman Act out of the closet, which had been unused since Sherman passed it. Dead letter. Nobody cared about it. The only effect it had was instead of having cartels, they had mergers. Remember? In the late 1890s, there was a great merger boom. Figure cartels might violate the Sherman Act, but mergers certainly won't. So mergers are really worse than cartels from the point of view of the consumer, because they're more permanent. You know, cartel can dissolve and break up. Merger is very difficult to break up. So the result of the Antitrust Act is to enforce a stronger trust, so to speak, than would have been without it. But anyway, it was a dead letter. It had never been used. All of a sudden, Teddy Roosevelt takes that out of the closet and uses it savagely to break up Standard Oil. In other words, Teddy Roosevelt breaks the informal. Before that, the Rockefeller-Morgan competition was much more polite. It was within certain rules of the game. Okay? Morgan was running the Democratic Party. He was in favor of the gold standard and free trade, and Rockefeller was in favor of tariffs and inflation. But really, it wasn't a savage war to the knife. All of a sudden, Roosevelt breaks the rules and goes for the jugular. So we have to break up Standard Oil. It's a bad trust. We have to smash it. This is really sort of going for broke. He starts a savage attack on Standard Oil. He also tried to break up Northern Securities Corporation. And most historians say that this shows he's also against Morgan. But the result of the judicial decision was to benefit the Morgan forces. In other words, they broke it up, they had a new arrangement, and the result of the arrangement was to reinforce Morgan's control over Northern Securities and Northern Pacific. So this is really a pro-Morgan action, even though historians say, well, look, Morgan didn't like it and so forth, but it really amounted to a pro-Morgan act. But the key thing in this warfare was to try to break up Standard Oil as being evil and monopolistic. Attorney General Knox was happy to do it, being a Morgan person. But the question is here, it has not been satisfactorily dealt with by historians. Why do they do this? Why do the Morgans decide to go all out? I should also talk about Teddy Roosevelt's cabinet. In addition to Knox, Teddy Roosevelt appoints Elihu Root, Secretary of War, and becomes Secretary of State. Secretary of State Elihu Root, who had been Secretary of War under McKinley, but a minor figure. Elihu Root was a Wall Street lawyer, very important Wall Street lawyer, had been a top lawyer for Thomas Fortune Ryan, a New York City financier, and then for Morgan. As a matter of fact, he resigned as Secretary of War in order to help Morgan defend Morgan and the Northern Securities Corporation, also to help Morgan invest in China. He was a personal attorney for J.P. Morgan. He then comes back as Secretary of State for Teddy Roosevelt, one of the top advisors. And originally, he's supposed to be Roosevelt's successor as president. As a matter of fact, the reason Root turned it down, he said, well, I can't really run for president in 1908 because I'm a Morgan's lawyer. I can't run as a Morgan. I have to be bigger, better front than that. I mean, nobody's going to elect me. I'm openly known as a Morgan's personal lawyer. Assistant Secretary of State. In other words, here's Elihu Root, Secretary of State. His assistant. Remember, in those days, there was only one assistant. They didn't have a whole fleet of deputies and undersecretaries and all that sort of stuff now, as they do now. It was Robert Bacon, Morgan partner. Okay. So we have total Morgan control of the government now, as Teddy Roosevelt comes in. Secretary of State, Elihu Root, Undersecretary Robert Bacon, Morgan partner. Postmaster General is a guy named George von Meyer. Who was a Morgan agent, an agent of the House of Morgan. Secretary of the Navy was a guy named Paul Morton, who was an industrialist and a Morgan president of Equitable Life Insurance Company, which is a Morgan company. Former vice president of Atchison, Topeka, and Santa Fe Railroad, Elihu Root, Robert Bacon, assistant secretary. So we have Postmaster General as a Morgan person. Secretary of the Navy was a Morgan person, which is more important than the Secretary of War, because the Navy was the major military arm in those days. Assistant Secretary of the Navy, right? Navy was Paul Morton, of the Morgan financial interests. And Assistant Secretary of the Navy was Herbert Satterlee, who was Morgan's son-in-law. I get much closer than that. But he was the Assistant Secretary. The total, frankly, dominant Morgan administration. Also, in addition to that, Root was extremely important. From Root comes most of our foreign policy establishment ever since. So right now, we're almost still being run by Root disciples. For example, Root's major disciple was a guy named Henry Stimson, whom Teddy Roosevelt was a law partner and disciple of, protege of Root, becomes district attorney of New York, and then gets the Republican nomination for governorship of New York due to Teddy Roosevelt's intervention. Stimson was the mentor of Acheson, Dean Acheson, who becomes very important, of course, in the Roosevelt-Truman administrations. And Acheson was a mentor of Bundy, the two Bundy brothers, who are still sort of elder statesmen, but they're basically running at least the Democratic wing of the foreign policy establishment. So it all stems, it's a total genealogy stemming from Root, Stimson, Acheson, all Morgan. So when you say Root, Stimson, Acheson, it's really Morgan. Morgan, by the way, was so satisfied with Teddy Roosevelt's performance in office, he personally donated $150,000 to Teddy Roosevelt's re-election campaign in 1904. In 1904, after here he's trying to savagely break up Standard Oil, Poor Rockefeller, almost all the big business groups supported Teddy Roosevelt's re-election. He won in a landslide, except for Rockefeller, who supported the Democratic choice Judge George Parker, that was wiped out, some unknown figure. So the question is, why did Teddy Roosevelt do this? And my contention is, which I guess I said on the tape, is I think it seems to be related to the international oil war that developed around 1900. That is the fact that Standard Oil, which had been dominant in the foreign oil markets in Asia and Europe, is now being challenged by the Nobel Royal Dutch Shell group, Dutch, Indonesian, English group, financed by the Rothschilds, and that this has kind of a mighty international oil war. It starts around 1900, continues really for about 40 years at least, between the Royal Dutch Shell Group, Rothschild Royal Dutch Shell Group, and Standard Oil. And so what you have is a titanic struggle covering the entire world, really, and influencing politics in Persia and God knows where else, everywhere, South America and Asia and all sorts of other places, between Standard Oil and Rothschild interests. Morgan's being associated with the Rothschilds. Seems to me it makes a lot of sense that the Morgan savage attack on Rockefeller is not a coincidence that it happened just about the time when the international oil competition became really serious between Rothschilds and the Rockefellers. So that's my hypothesis. I can't prove it because nobody's really investigated this, but it seems to me it makes a lot of sense. Why does Teddy Roosevelt suddenly break the rules and go all out for the jugular, you know, go for the throat? It seems to me it's connected with the international oil war. So Teddy Roosevelt is re-nominated and re-elected and begins this whole progressive era in politics, and federal politics really begins with Teddy. I should say, I'm going to give you one in the next hour. I have it in my briefcase. Readings for the next block of, next period, next few weeks, essentially the rest of the Kokol and Weinstein books, with a couple of exception chapters, which are exempt on banking and things, which are a little esoteric. But, Weinstein and Kokol go into this whole progressive period at some length, and it's a key aspect of the whole thing, because this is the beginning of a modern warfare state in the United States, and really throughout the Western world. Because the same things are beginning to happen in Western Europe too. what we have is the big business, as I say, Morgan's, and even the Rockefellers, at least in the abstract, although they don't like the way it's being run, essentially saying, look, we tried a monopoly in the free market, it doesn't work, we try cartels, we try mergers, they don't work, therefore we have to turn to the federal government to impose it for us, to enforce cartels, also state and local governments, as we'll see too, supplement it. We have to sell it to the public. We can't say we want a monopoly. We have to sell it to the public on the basis of attacking big business. Big business is a threat. And we need the federal and state regulatory commissions to guide the general welfare, to curb big business, to have democracy and that sort of stuff. And they turn as allies in this thing. Big business turns to intellectuals who are coming up, intellectuals, technocrats, etc., who are rising in this period with their own agenda. And then you have the importance of Weinstein's Chapter 1 of the National Civic Federation, which is an alliance of big business and progressive intellectuals. And intellectuals are coming up in many fields. Various groups of coming professions. Engineers, for example, used to be tool and dime men. They didn't go to university or institutes. They were on the job types. They then become professional engineers, civil engineers, electrical engineers, and all that. They all want part of the pie. They want to run the system. They want privileges, and they want to keep out competition. So the government, and since they set up an alliance, not just engineers, psychiatrists, doctors, we'll go into many of this stuff, physicians, economists, historians, social scientists, all these guys they're getting PhDs. For example, there had been no PhDs before. The only PhDs were essentially in Germany. United States, there were no PhDs until about 1880s, 70s, 80s. I think Johns Hopkins started it. He didn't have the idea that everybody has to go to college either. A very small portion of the people went to college, maybe 3% of the population. Everybody else started working. So the idea of being professional graduate school people and professional political scientists and whatever. This only starts in the 1880s, and since there were no American school giving PhDs, they all went to Germany. They went to the University of Berlin and Göttingen and so forth and so on. And in Germany, they imbibed the German ideological setup, which in those days was which had become welfare, warfare, state-oriented. They imbibed a sort of statism and collectivism in Germany. They came back fired up with enthusiasm. This is great stuff. Because it's meant for one thing, and these intellectuals, one, could help plan the system. If government's planning the system, they've got to have some people to do it. And who's going to do it? Experts in the field. Engineers will help plan industry. Economists will help plan everything. Historians will help do something. Political scientists will help plan stuff. So they become planners. They also become apologists for the system. They become hired as court apologists, explaining to the public why you have to have government planning, government war, government racial experimentation, all sorts of other stuff. So intellectuals become apologists for the system and also planners. And also the government can supply intellectuals with guild restrictions, with monopoly restrictionism, keeping out competition, licensing the field, licensing doctors, licensing hospitals, licensing engineers, whatever it is, to keep out, to restrict the supply of the people in the field, right? This is the price, wage rates on the y-axis, and quantity on the x-axis. This is the number of engineers or physicists or whatever, and if you can license them, you restrict the supply and raise the wage rate. So in other words, government can help intellectuals by providing them with job status, helping plan the system, apologizing for the system, and also restricting entry, restricting the field, cartelizing, in other words. And what can intellectuals do for government? Well, very simple. They can tell the people why the government intervention is necessary and just and correct and modern, and all sorts of other things. In other words, what happens here is that in 1900 or so, we begin the reforging of an alliance, which had been the standard alliance all through history, really. In other words, from the dawn of civilization until, say, 17th century, 18th century, the world was run by governments, which were essentially alliances of the king, which is the state, the king and his nobles and the state apparatus, and intellectuals would apologize for the state, and tell the public why the state has to be obeyed. The king rules by divine right, the king is just and wise and good and necessary, etc., etc. In some cases, the king is even divine himself. In Oriental civilizations, when the intellectuals could get away with it, they claimed the king was divine, the king was God himself. If the king is God, you have to obey him, even though he might be a turkey. He's still God himself. So, intellectuals then provide the ideology, engineering the consent of the public to the rule of the government, and in return for that, they get cut in on the sum of boodle. They get a part of a cut of the loot. This is the, of course, before the 17th and 18th century, almost all intellectuals were churchmen. They were priests, they were ministers, whatever you want to call them. There were no lay intellectuals. There were no pamphleteers, professors, or whatever, outside the church. And so what you have is a state domination by state and church, or throne and altar, is another way to put it. A grand alliance between throne, the king, and the priest, the altar. And the American idea of separation of church and state is very extremely important, not just because of the slogan. The idea is you prevent a link-up between these two powerful institutions, between the government and intellectuals, or organized opinion, so to speak, opinion molding. Because if they're allied together, the average citizen is going to be screwed. They're going to be dominated by this alliance. If you prevent the alliance, you'll have independent judgment, room for independent judgment for checking on the king, for example. If you allow separation, if you prevent this kind of alliance or merger in state and church. But then in the 18th and 19th centuries, basically, intellectuals religion was more or less separated from the government. There were also lay intellectuals, secular intellectuals, and not churchmen, who were just independent types. And what you begin to have now with the progressive period is a re-emergence in a different form of the old church-state alliance, the throne-walls alliance, the alliance of government and intellectuals, of the king, the president, whatever you want to call them, like the Führer, whatever the term is, and the intelligentsia. Each one getting their old cozy position of the alliance, the church telling the state, telling the public why they have to obey the king, and the king cutting the church into part of the swag. Same thing is now happening in a different form, with secular intellectuals and religious intellectuals too. The pietist ministers come in here too, of course, in a big way. As we'll see with the Progressive Party. So what you begin to have then is a new form, a secularized version of this throne altar concept. And many of these intellectuals, by the way, this links us with the whole pietist liturgical stuff. Many of these guys, the progressive political scientists, economists, historians, etc., were originally extreme pietists. This happens in almost every case. I'll give you a case study of it today. And what happens in almost every case, these guys were born in a Yankee farm country, upstate New York in most cases, or upstate, you know, northern Indiana or something like that. They're born in extreme pietist Protestant sects, a Campbellite sect, for example, things like that. They then go to college. They become atheists. They drop their religion. They come to the conclusion that science outlaws religion, or science shows that religion is ridiculous, or whatever. And they become secularized pietists. In other words, instead of saying the government, we need the government in order to have salvation, we have to stamp out sin. Now they say we have to stamp out sin, quote unquote, for the benefit of the public welfare, the general good, etc. We have to stamp out capitalism or private property, whatever it happens to be. And when they have a government crusade, a sort of a secularized version of a religious pietism, usually by the same guys, just transferring their imagery of their allegiance from the church or from salvation through being born again, to salvation through government. Government, as Richard W. Ely, was a major figure in the economics profession, shifting economics from laissez-faire to progressive government intervention. Richard D. Ely said he started out as a government, as a pietist minister, and one quote from Ely is, I think, magnificent. It sums up this whole thing. He says, government is God's major instrument of redemption. I'll underline that again. Government is God's major instrument of redemption. In other words, the way to redeem through salvation is through use of government power to the utmost, to fix everything up, to cure everything, to run everything, and so forth and so on. He was a major progressive economist. This is progressivism at most, at the clearest. His assistants, he went to the University of Wisconsin. He was the founder of the so-called Wisconsin Idea. His assistants in Wisconsin became big shots in Teddy Roosevelt organizations and new National Civic Federation and the rest of it. Yeah.
What kind of union?
You mean labor unions or organizations? Well, they form all sorts of stuff. The National Civic Federation is one clear example, which founded by big business groups, include progressive intellectuals, social workers, a few labor union leaders, technocrats, whatever. Oh, you mean the? Well, I'm not talking about the individual labor union. I'm talking about these are ideological organizations we're talking about. In other words, National Civic Federation is a big business group, including economists, intellectuals, social workers, and things like that, to push for government regulation of all sorts, welfare state or government regulation in general. I'm not talking about labor unions. I'm talking about the organizations to organize for government intervention. So there are all sorts of, there's the Progressive Party, there's all sorts of clubs and lobbying groups and things like that, think tanks, where all these people get together. I'll mention a couple. National Civic Federation is a famous case, the leading group from up until World War I. That's in the Weinstein book. It has Morgan in it, it has all the Morgan people, it has all the big business people, plus a whole bunch of economists, historians, political scientists, blah, blah, blah. AFL, a couple of AFL representatives, things like that. Now, labor unions were crafted until the 1930s. Anyway, when we get back from the break, I will talk about two things in particular, two examples of Teddy Roosevelt government regulation which have been misunderstood. One is the meatpacking paper, meatpacking regulation, the other is the Sugar Trust and the Food and Drug Act, which comes in finally with Teddy Roosevelt. Okay, let's take a 10-minute break. Before the term is over, an update, current update of the Rockefeller-Morgan situation. I have two examples here of Teddy Roosevelt regulation, important regulation, both of which were passed in the same month, in June 1906, as the second Teddy Roosevelt term. One is the Meatpacking Act. It's called the Federal Meat Inspection Act. Coco has a discussion of this. Oh, damn it. I should, I wanted to bring in the chapters to read here. Wait a minute, I'll be right back. We should read next, especially the rest of the book, but Weinstein, I've already assigned chapter 1, which is National Civic Federation. Chapters 1, 2, 3, 4, and 6. We'll end up with 8, which is World War I, but this is the Weinstein chapters. Dealing with progressivism, National Civic Federation, also local progressivism, which is very important, local government. And COCO, chapters, I've already assigned 1 and 2, dealing with the merger movement. Chapters 3, 4, 5, 7, 8, and 10. I'm just omitting the banking stuff, it's a little too technical, I think. So, although very important, if you want to read it, great, but I just want to concentrate on the industrial stuff. So Weinstein deals with the intellectuals, National Civic Federation, and local government, and COCO with the industrial, national industrial regulation, including the meatpacking. The usual myth, a standard myth in historical books, at least until the 60s, was the meatpacking was in terrible shape, the so-called beef trust of the large meatpackers, Armour, Smith, Cudahy, the other one, Swift, in Chicago. And then there are a lot of local meat packers all over the place, local slaughterhouses. The usual myth was that, progressive myth, so to speak, is you have this meat which is being produced. Meat was diseased, it was terrible shape, people were dying from it or whatever. And Upton Sinclair wrote a book called, a novel called The Jungle. Upton Sinclair was a socialist intellectual. Muckraking novel called The Jungle. And exposed the evil conditions of diseased meat in the meatpacking industry and so forth and so on. And because of that, the public rose up and demanded a federal meat inspection, federal regulation of meat and meat inspection, which was then passed by Teddy Roosevelt over the objection of the meatpacking interests, the Armour, Smith, and Cudahy, opposing federal control, federal regulation. So this is the general, and this all happened within about a year. In other words, I think the jungle came out by 1905 or so, and then the law was passed in 1906. this whole thing is a lie from start to finish. Every part of this myth is incorrect. So if you've heard it or read it in the high school textbooks, it's all wrong. The actual situation was very different. The actual situation was the big meat packers were calling for federal inspection for 20, 30 years, since the 1880s. They were asking for it. They wanted it. Why do they want it? Because they wanted to screw their competitors, the small meat packers. In other words, they wanted, if you have a costly federal regulation, let's say where the federal government says you have to fill out 20 forms and have an inspector, it's costly. It means it imposes a high fixed cost on operation, which means the small businessman, the small competitor is shafted and to the advantage of the big one. In other words, if you have a big businessman can hire one guy to sit on the desk and fill out the forms. The small businessman can't do that. It might have only 3 employees. You can't have one guy doing a full-time form fill out. So for these various reasons, what you're doing is you're shafting your small competitors. And so the meat packers have been calling for government inspection since the 1880s. For one thing, also, they wanted to get European governments started to prohibit meat imports because they wanted to protect their own farmers. And the excuse was that foreign meat is diseased. We can't import American meat because it's diseased. The same thing now in Argentina. We can't import Argentinian beef because it's diseased. So you use a specter of disease, and most people are hypochondriacs because it can be induced in becoming hypochondriacs. Disease, therefore you shouldn't import, you should have American meat. Well, the Europeans are doing the same thing. So the meat packers wanted to have a U.S. government imprimatur saying this meat has been inspected by the U.S. government, so therefore the European governments would allow the import of that meat. So it's sort of like using the government to socialize your cost, to give you a stamp of approval. And also, of course, as I say, to keep out the smaller competitors. So you're doing two things here. The U.S. government, by labeling the meat as safe, so to speak, is pushing exports and also restricting the supply of American meat. So you're doing two things for the benefit of the large meat packers. So Chicago, the large meat packers being concentrated, as I say, in Chicago, Armour, Swift, and Cudahy, they got the Chicago city government to have inspection from the 1880s on, but this did not keep out the southern meat packers, the small small meat packers in the South, small slaughterhouses in the West, and that sort of thing. So they wanted to have a federal government do it. In other words, the major meat packers, these Armour, Smith and Cudahy, were behind. They were the ones pushing the federal meat inspection. As I say, for many years, for about 20, 25 years, and the Congress in 1891 began to do that. They began to have federal meat inspection. So the problem was that as a matter of fact, they passed, as I say, 1891 federal meat inspection law. So in a few years, the federal government was inspecting about 75% of American beef. The problem was that the smaller competitors were able to avoid the inspection. They were able to get around it. They were not visible, so they were able to get through the gate, so to speak. So the idea was, in order for this cartel to succeed, you had to force the small meat packers to be inspected. And that was the whole idea, to step up the enforcement procedures so as to screw the small meat packers. Not that the small meat packers are diseased meat, but just that you make them fill out all sorts of forms and regulations and whatever. There's all sorts of stuff, by the way. Probably the single most hated government agency right now is obviously IRS. We know it's coming up April 15th. We all know that. The second most hated outside of New York, where everything is visible, is OSHA, the Office of Safety and Health Administration, I guess, OSHA, which inspects all small businesses and has all sorts of crazy safety regulations. And my brother-in-law, for example, is a printer in Virginia. He said if OSHA ever came there to try and enforce the regulation, he'd just hand them the keys. He couldn't operate. There are all sorts of crazy things. The wires have to be, sealed, whatever it is. It costs about three times as much as a non-OSHA inspected plant. It's no more safe. It's just regulations imposed by bureaucrats. For example, they're always trying to kill the sheep herding industry in the West because they want the force of the sheep herders, the ranchers, to have portable toilets for every sheep herder. The whole thing is absurd. You walk around with a big cabin, portable cabin for toilets. And it's extremely costly and idiotic. I know the sheep herders don't want it. They think it's idiotic. It's just somebody in Washington is imposing this. At any rate, so the large meat packers wanted to spread the enforcement to the small competitors, especially because small competitors were growing. Competitive pressure. There were about 1,000 meat packers in 1900. By 1909, there were 1,600 because as they were getting more cartelization, getting higher profits, new businesses came in. New smaller meat packers came in to outcompete Swift and Armour, etc., with lower costs and all the rest of it. So, at any rate, what happened was that the. And also another thing is that Sinclair's jungle had nothing to do with diseased meat. Nothing to do with it. He wasn't concerned with that. He was worried about working conditions. He said the workers aren't getting paid enough, not getting enough light. He didn't talk about the meat that was coming off the meat pack. He was talking about the conditions of the workers in the meat packing plants. And so he said the whole thing is he wasn't interested in the federal meat inspection. See? He said the whole thing is a racket from his point of view. Anyway, when Sinclair's jungle came out in early 1906, right? Remember this is the novel comes out in early 1906. The law was passed in June 1906. It only took about 3 months. When the book came out, J. Ogden Armour, who was the owner of Armour Meatpacking, and still is one of the biggest meatpacking firms in the country, he wrote an article in the Saturday Evening Post, which was the biggest weekly magazine at the time, popular magazine. He defends government inspection of meat, and he calls for more inspection. And he said the large packers had always favored inspection, always pushed for it, which is true. Here's what he writes. Quote, this is from J. Ogden Armour, March 1906. It's quoted in Coco. There's a very good discussion on this. He says, to attempt to evade government inspection would be, from the purely commercial viewpoint, suicidal. No packer can do an interstate or export business without government inspection. Self-interest forces him to make use of it. Self-interest likewise demands that he shall not receive meats or byproducts from any small packer, either for export or other use, unless that small packer's plant is also official, that is, under U.S. government inspection. This government inspection thus becomes an important adjunct of a packer's business from two viewpoints. It puts the stamp of legitimacy and honesty upon the packer's product, and so is to him a necessity. To the public, it is insurance against the sale of diseased meats. In other words, the government then puts a stamp of approval for export and for domestic firms on this meat packer. Doesn't mean the meat's really any better. See, one of the problems about government inspection is it lulls the public into thinking the food is good or safe or whatever. Because it has a government stamp of approval, they don't have to worry about competitive looking at it further, which is in many cases a mistake. So what happens is, Armour writes this article. In May 1906, Senator Beveridge of Indiana, who's a big progressive Republican and an old friend of George W. Perkins Morgan partner, introduces a bill for meat inspection, compulsory meat inspection. The bill is vigorously supported by the Secretary of Agriculture, funds are quadrupled for inspection, blah, 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 and it passes unanimously both houses of Congress. That's the federal meat inspection law, unanimous. The large meat packers, when the bill was passed, were enthusiastically in favor of it because it was designed to bring the small packers under federal inspection. The American Meat Packers Association endorsed the bill. Thomas Wilson, that's the fourth big packer. Armour, Swift, Cudahy, and Wilson. So Thomas Wilson, the head of the Wilson Packing Company, Meat Packing Company, the hearings of the House Committee of Agriculture on the packing on this bill puts the whole position of the large Chicago packers. He says, quote, "We are now and always have been in favor of the extension of inspection. We have always felt the government inspection under proper regulations is an advantage to the livestock and agricultural interests and to the consumer. And of course, this also means, I say, that it imposes costs on a small firm much more heavily than on a large one." So Perkins, when the bill passes, Perkins is delighted, and he writes to Morgan himself, and he says, "This is great. The new law," he says, quote, "will certainly be a very great advantage when the thing once gets in operation and they're able to use it all over the world, as it will practically give them a government certificate for their goods." In other words, government certificate, a badge of approval. The only opposition was they wanted the meat packers to pay more of it. That was the only question was who should pay for the inspection. Some of the leftist opponents of business were clear on this thing. They realized the whole thing was a meatpacker scam. Senator Nelson, for example, said that the law of the meatpacker's bonanza. Upton Sinclair, as I said, realized that the law was designed to benefit the packers and was against it. But nobody cared about this in the general approval. So after the law was passed, Swift and Company and the other large packers took out full-page ads all over the country hailing the bill, saying it was great, and the purpose, it said, quote, "was to assure the public that only sound and wholesome meat and meat food products may be offered for sale. It is a wise law. Its enforcement must be universal and uniform," unquote. Because that's the meatpacking. The meatpacking thing was had nothing to do with Upton Sinclair's The Jungle. That was just a cover. It was a law pushed by the meatpackers for 20 or 30 years, and they finally used the agitation from the novel to push through a law they've been always in favor of, namely to try to screw the small meat packers and to cartelize the meat packing industry for their benefit. The next case study, I think is even more interesting, is the Pure Food and Drug Act, which came in the same month, June 1906, allegedly to help the purity of food and all that, which is now, of course, the FDA is now regulating the drug industry and all that sort of thing, all over the place, keeps regulating for cancer and all the rest of it. How does this thing start? It starts off with one guy, the main agitator for this thing for many years. His name is Harvey W. Wiley. Again, this is the cocoa to some of this. It's sort of a prototype. I think he's a fascinating character. It's sort of a prototype of this whole progressive movement. Harvey W. Wiley was the leading food chemist for the Department of Agriculture. In fact, he started off as the only food chemist, Department of Agriculture. He was born in Indiana, a farm boy of Ulster Scottish Presbyterian background, to a father who was a lay preacher in an ultra-pietistic Campbellite sect, which was even more pietistic than the Presbyterians in general, Campbellite Scottish Presbyterian sect. So his father was a preacher, a lay preacher, the Campbellite movement. The whole Wiley home was very Sabbatarian. Remember the thing about the Pietists? They kept the Sabbath with great enthusiasm. Can't do anything on the Sabbath except pray. Anything else on Sunday except pray is evil and sinful, etc. Then Wiley goes to Hanover College, which was a Campbellite college in Indiana. He begins his lifelong obsession with purity, quote-unquote, purity, unquote, and begins to give lectures to his classmates and to the school in general on the purity of body, mind, and soul, the importance of purity. He was very early convinced that tobacco and pork were foul impurities and mar the perfection of one's body. Remember those, I mean, the cancer thing of tobacco was only very recent. I mean, nobody had that doctrine. He gives a commencement address, valedictorian, 1867, in Hanover College. And he combines the themes of purity, pietism, and value-free medicine, quote-unquote, in ways that would foreshadow his later career. He declared that man must preserve his godlike purity of body and mind. He exalted the nobility of physicians, men who, quote, guard the holy covenant God made with man. Physicians, he concluded, may not be able to make man immortal, but he, quote, he may help to make the probation state a proper place of preparation, probation state of man's life on earth. Physician may help to make the probation state a proper place of preparation for the precious life that beckons from beyond the misty hills, I mean, towards heaven. After delivering this commencement address on purity, he went on to tutor languages at Northwestern Christian University, at Campbellite University in Indianapolis. And then he went to Indiana Medical College and got an M.D. in 1871, became a physician. He then shifted his interest to chemistry, becoming a professor of chemistry at Indiana Medical School, obtaining a B.S. in chemistry at Harvard, and became professor of chemistry at Northwestern Christian, and becomes a professor of chemistry at newly founded Purdue University in 1874. So then 5 years later, he studies medicine, chemistry, and physics at the University of Berlin, where he was inspired by Dr. Sell's government laboratory for detecting impurities in food and drink. Start with impurity of soul, and you wind up at the end, continue with impurity of food. It was at Berlin, Wiley picked up his other big lifelong interest. In addition to purity, sugar chemistry. Big sugar chemistry fan. Okay. Began his permanent alliance with the U.S. sugar industry and with government in the United States. Comes back here in 1881. He begins to agitate for the government's protecting the consumer from adulterated sugar products in the state of Indiana. Specifically, he calls for a state requirement that sugar and syrup products be required to carry labels detailing their composition. Beginning of compulsory labeling. Notice the analogy here with compulsory publicity for corporation. Compulsory label. So, by requiring compulsory publicity means you cripple trade secrets, in other words, brand name secrets, thereby helping to restrict competition in the sugar industry, to cartelize the sugar industry. Very similar. Compulsory labeling, compulsory ingredients means you can't have, you know, like Coca-Cola can't have its magic syrup or something. You force the publicity ingredients. By adulterating sugar, by the way, he didn't mean poison or something like that. He had a very peculiar definition of adulteration, of food, etc. By adulteration, he meant any change in the name and definition. Very peculiar guy, Wiley, but fits in with the progressive doctrine.